Hi, my name is Adrian. I am an alcoholic. My home group is the Weekend Group in Brooklyn, New York, and you're all invited. My sobriety date, because you do as the Romans do, as my grandmother used to say, my sobriety date is October 29th, 1984. I love it when Dot says I spoke at the quarterly. It was in, I mean, who keeps track, but it was in 97. And yes, they invited me back, 98, 99, 2000, 2001. But I'm so glad I finally got back here. Congratulations on the 45th state convention. Our AA history says that very early it was the AA headquarters. It sounds like something in the sky. And at these AA headquarters, Bill W. sat there and with one secretary, and he responded to questions as the little fledgling groups began to grow and have problems. And they'd write Bill, and he'd put his feet up, and he'd dictate long responses and how the groups could better carry the AA message. And if someone needed to talk, the newspapers wanted to speak to someone about AA, Bill spoke to the newspapers. If the clergy or the physicians wanted information about AA, Bill provided the information to the clergy and to the physicians. If there were new hospitals opening and they wanted to find out how they could get AA in there, or the prisons, Bill sat there and wrote wonderful letters. Well, I guess Bill couldn't keep doing everything by himself, just him and one secretary. So eventually, AA headquarters became the General Service Office of Alcoholics Anonymous. So today I bring greetings from nearly 80 employees paid, and we do the work that Bill and one secretary used to do. Thank you. I work for you. I'm one of 10 staff members who have to be recovering alcoholics. Who would have thought I would get a job where I had to be a recovering alcoholic? Very briefly, because I am here, I am from your General Service Office, but I also have to tell my story. But my assignment, we all have assignments, and mine is correctional facilities. Now, I don't know if you saw the July issue of Grapevine. AA in prison. There is an article, it's a great, best issue I've ever read. And in here, there is one about the correctional facilities assignment, which I happen to serve on currently. And no, my picture is not in here. I asked about it, but they said no. What I do is I receive the most mail. Well, I used to receive, I do receive the most physical mail. Eva, who's on international assignment, receives quite a bit of email from all over the world. But I get the actual letters from inmates, about 150 a week, asking for AA meetings, asking for pre-release contacts, and also asking for literature, and asking to participate in the corrections correspondence service. Now, this is where inmates correspond with outside AA members who are willing to share AA experience. Not the love line, not sending any money. We just like you to share your AA experience with an inmate. And our AAs are doing such a good job of letting the inmates know that this service is available, but we don't seem to be able to keep up with outside members who are willing to write. So please, if you're interested, or if you know someone that's interested in writing to an inmate, see me. I have some of these. You can make copies of them. And also, there's a workshop on Saturday at 3 o'clock, Brian? 3:30. If you want to know more about doing this rewarding, special type of 12-step work, come to that workshop. How many people here have ever either taken a meeting into a correctional facility currently or now? Could you raise your hand? Excellent. And how many people have spoken in the correctional facility? Oh, and for all y'all who didn't raise your hand, see the people who had their hands raised, because we're always looking for help. We're always looking for help. You know, I've had the opportunity to, since being at the office, it'll be 5 years in October, I came in for 1 year on the treatment facilities assignment, working with the committees who carry the message into treatment facilities. And I thought that was the most wonderful job anyone could have. And then I rotated into cooperation with the professional community. And that was working with the committees and the professionals, letting them know where AA is, how to find us, and what we do. And then I thought, well, I've arrived. This is wonderful. I love doing CPC work. And then I rotated into corrections. And I have had the incredible experience of, yes, sometimes getting the 75th letter that day written in pencil on long sheets of paper, about 7 pages of it, all up and down the margins, all the way around. And I'm going like, if I have to read one more letter today, and then I read one more letter, and it's somebody that had one of those inmate checks for a dollar, and they sent it in to pay for a big book on the installment plan. So then it's like, okay, I'll read another letter today. Yeah, I get to the office, and I get off. We're located, by the way, at 475 Riverside Drive on the 11th floor in New York City, behind Columbia and Barnard Universities. And so when you're in New York, please stop by and visit your office. You can we'll take you on a tour. And if you come on Fridays, Bill Wilson and his wisdom, every Friday at 11 o'clock, we have an open AA meeting. I guess they figure if the staff wasn't making any all week, they'd make one on Friday. So you're all invited to the open meeting on Fridays. So I get off the elevator in the morning, and I see Dr. Bob's last message and Bill's farewell talk, and I go through the doors and see the archives, go around the little corner, and then there's the office, and there's a little name plate outside on the wall, and it says Adrian Brown, Correctional Facilities Coordinator. You know, and I think, you know, how do you get from there to here? Our story is disclosed in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now, sober in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up in Harlem. I lived with my mother, my grandmother, and my grandfather. I knew my father. The story goes, he was drunk. I think he thought about hitting my mother. She heard him thinking about it, and she hit him in with a frying pan. And she left, never went back, and that's where I grew up with my grandmother. My grandmother was a matriarch, you know, I don't like that. But they call her Nick, so that gives you an idea how she was. Nick I got all my information from Nick about life. Never trust a man that don't drink. You know? Yeah. You know, and I would hear her tell my father, you know, don't promise Adrian anything, because if you can't keep your promises, she'll be disappointed, and Adrian should never be disappointed. Interesting philosophy. Not very realistic, but interesting. My grandfather worked on the railroad. He was a cook, and he came home once a week. I used to tell this story, and he worked the New York to Boston run. And I would tell, you know, you come there, you start telling your story. And then one day it dawned on me, New York to Boston. Why was he only coming on once a week? Yeah. But I guess if you live with my grandmother, perhaps you'd only come home once a week. Yeah. So a little bit about my personality, because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was bad enough I had to come here, because I was not happy about coming here. And then I remember hearing somebody say, there was something terribly wrong with you before you picked up the drink. And I went, oh, give me a break. It's bad enough I'm here. And now there was something wrong even before I picked up the drink. Well, there were some things I heard as a child. I would often hear, Adrian, you can't have your cake and eat it too, which I thought was one of the silliest things. I mean, why have the cake if you can't eat it? You know, but I also grew up where you didn't say what you thought, because I honestly thought that my grandmother would kill me. And then I heard things like, you ungrateful wench. Heard that a lot. I thought my grandmother had seen too many pirate movies. And so that also gives you an idea about what, if no concept of gratitude when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I also, and my grandmother would say this, Adrian, you walk around like the world owe you a living. And I did. And I don't know where that came from. I don't know where that came from, that it was just something about my personality. I saw what alcohol did to people. Because, you know, my aunt tells me, and my aunt, my mother had one brother, and they raised me after my mother passed. And my aunt is 15 years between us, and we're much better with each other today. But she said that she couldn't stand me as a child, and I don't know why. I mean, self-centered to the extreme. I had a grandmother that waited on my every need. I was a Jewish princess. I was taught how to do everything, but had to do nothing. Who wouldn't love a child like that? Then they made the mistake of telling me that I was gifted, you know, the gifted, the potential, you know, all that. And so that just fed right into it. And then somewhere along the line, I realized that I knew everything. I don't know how that happened. I just figured out, because it just seemed like I knew everything. And it's overwhelming responsibility that when you ask me something, I had to have the answer. I heard someone share earlier, you know, I couldn't just say I didn't know, you know. It would disappoint you. I mean, you took all the time to ask me. It was my responsibility to give you an answer. And then somewhere along the line, it dawned on me, too, that if you were asking me, obviously you didn't know, so I'd make it up. And these were the life skills that I had. So this is the kid that was walking around, and then I would see my grandfather, his brothers would come over. It's very similar to what I heard this morning, and everybody would be, you know, all happy, and then one brother would bring up the fact that the other brother didn't bring that one from down south when he was supposed to, and then they get a resentment, and one start, you know, they start cussing and fighting, and then they crying, and then they singing Negro spirituals, harmonizing too. Yeah, so I could see the routine, it would happen, and I remember saying, you know, to myself that I was never going to drink, I was never going to smoke cigarettes, and I wasn't going to have sex before I got married. Well, I'm a woman, I'm an alcoholic, and everything that comes with following that drink happened to me. I finally made the connection with alcohol. Oh, see, look, I took the watch off. Don't you love it? We take the watch off and never look at it because it's all the way over here. Excuse me. Because they do want you to kind of stay within some kind of, I am responsible today and I follow instructions. But I made the connection with alcohol. I went away to college, actually. I went away to college. And, before I mention that, I should say that at 15 years old, my mother died. At 16, my grandmother died. That is not why I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic, mental obsession, physical compulsion, what happens when I take that first drink. God, that's so simple, and I never knew that. You know. I tasted alcohol, oh, nasty, why people drink this stuff, you know. It's amazing how, and then something happens, that moment, when I forgot about never going to drink, you know, it tastes nasty, people act stupid when they do it. That day at my surprise birthday party, when they passed me that drink, I was supposed to pass it to somebody, and I just decided, just like that, to drink it. And I remember people looking at me, because Adrian doesn't drink, because I've always made it, it's been part of my life that whatever I thought, you had to know, whether you wanted to know it or not. And I was very vocal about all of my opinions, because all of them were important. And so I had told everybody how I wasn't going to drink, wasn't going to have sex before I got married, wasn't going to smoke cigarettes. Well, after that birthday party and I took that drink, the magic happened for me. I got taller. I got slimmer. This haze came around my... Oh, I didn't need glasses for about 10 minutes. Yeah. And then I began, it didn't matter that my mother was dead, didn't matter that my grandmother was dead, who were they? I didn't need them. And now I was going to help everyone. I was going to fix your life. And I began, you know, when you're 18, everybody, you know, you lose one boyfriend, this one got a new boy. And I went around, I began fixing people's lives, giving them all the answers. And they were loving every minute of it, and I was helping them. And I proceeded to do that for the next 15 years. However, I'm an alcoholic. And by the end of my drinking, nobody wanted my help. You know, nobody wanted my help. And I didn't have the answers anymore. And matter of fact, I didn't really care anymore by the end of my drinking, because what I have is progressive. But in the beginning, I thought I had it going on. Yeah. I graduated from college because of some gifts that a power greater than myself have given me. But I watched things change. I watched alcoholism change me. And I was active politically and all these ideals early in, when I started drinking and going to college and going to change the world. And with the matter of 1 year, it was like I didn't care. I began to be bitter, and I remember not caring because the world wasn't going to change. Nothing I was going to do was going to make any difference. So what the heck? Let me just show up. I was going to learn the game and play it better than anybody else. And that's what I was going to do. And I came back to New York after college, and I went back to live with my grandfather. I was back in Harlem again. I picked up some other substances. I put them down because I thought I would just drink, because when I opened up that bottle, I knew what was in it. And that wasn't going to hurt me. I worked for a bank. Oh, gosh. And you know, you keep telling your story, and just the reality comes true. Like, this is a disease of delusion and not in touch with reality, and you think you're in touch with it till you keep hearing yourself after a while. So when I came to AA, I worked for a large financial institution, money market division, overnight Fed funds, buying and selling millions of dollars every day. I was a senior stock clerk. That's what I was. But when I came in here, I was the other thing. I had worked at the bank for about 8 years at that time. In between, again, if progressive, it gets worse, I wouldn't be here. My drinking is almost textbook. You know, isn't that ridiculous? I started drinking, I had a huge tolerance. I could drink like a man. I could drink like a fish. You know, I'd look one way, and I always had this kind of dual thing going on. I never looked like I am, you know. People, oh, you don't look like you drink that much, you know. I could go in places and people would think I was a narc because I looked so straight, you know. And I loved it, like I was fooling everybody. But what I have is progressive, and by the time I got here, I looked like everything I was. Okay. But there was a time when it wasn't like that. And even though I had a high tolerance, I also had terrible hangovers. And you would think that that would make you stop drinking, but I wasn't going to give it up for how it made me feel. So I had these terrible hangovers. I spent a lot of time in pharmacies reading the back of the labels. If it said it makes you drowsy or do not operate machinery, I took it. And trying to find the right combination, Brioski, Alka-Seltzer, you know, throw up early, throw up later, you know. And learning how to throw up, because when you wear glasses, you don't want to get splattered. So you have to do it in a certain way, you know. And just looking at the progression, where there was a time when I would get sick, and that meant you had to go home. You know, you're at the party, you drink, you get sick, you go home. Then it came a time when you get sick, you know, go have another drink, you know, swallow it, and hey, I'm ready again. That's what my life became. Hangovers, I'm bouncing back. When I was young, you know, party all night, take a shower, go to work, you know. Then it was party all night, not take a shower, go to work. Then it was like party all night, not go to work. I can still remember sitting on the side of the bed, making the phone call, you know, to call in so that you can sound sick. Yeah. And I've always found that when you tell lies, a little bit of truth always helps. And since I was always hungover, it was so easy. Oh, a headache, you know, diarrhea, you know. It just kind of flowed, you know. And I knew something was changing, but it couldn't have anything to do with the alcohol, because by that time in my life, alcohol was the only thing that helped me make sense of what was going on. I'm the one that used to go on ski trips, you know, and never put a coat on the whole time. I would come back and people said, oh, how was your weekend? I'd say, oh, the weekend of debauchery, drugs, and drink. And then people would look at you when you say stuff like that, and I thought I was cool, you know. And it started to look like, what is wrong with her, you know. But they were chumps. They didn't really understand what it was like being, you know, being me. You know, cool, all the answers, never let them see you sweat. You know, that was my personality. It got worse. I became everything that I couldn't stand. And I would tell you, again, because I felt it was important that you know this, I could not stand a repeating yourself, crying, pissy drunk. And that's what I became. Yeah. And I don't know how it happened. You know, I remember one time crying somewhere, not just cool crying. By now, it's just, you know, putting my head in people's laps and, you know, and people saying, what's wrong? And I didn't know. I remember somebody saying, Adrian, you help everybody else. Why can't, you know, we help you? And I didn't know what was wrong. And then just like a gentleman shared about people not telling us the truth. And the next day, nobody mentioning it. Nobody mentioned it. Cool Adrian's cried for 5 minutes in somebody's lap. You know, nobody mentions it. So I go, you go on, you know. My blackouts, I've had blackouts from the beginning when I was drinking. And that's such an interesting experience, too. When I couldn't remember what happened to me early in my drinking, people would say, girl, we had a good time last night. You was on. And I said, okay, that's fine. You know, no pain. That's all right. It's cool. By the end of my drinking, it was, you need to slow down. You know, do you know what you said last night? Do you know what you did last night? Yeah. And I didn't even have the mercy of total blackouts by the end of my drinking, because I would come out of them and I'd be talking to people that I had no idea who they were in this conversation where everybody's looking at me. So just keep talking, you know, have another drink and it's going to be all right. So I remember my first sponsor to say that she had to keep drinking because when she stopped drinking, it was so terrifying and humiliating, she couldn't stand it, so she had to take another drink. And that's how it was for me. By August of 1984, another night of I'm not going to go to the spot, I'm not going to go to the after hours joint. I was running tabs now in real nice bars. You know, I don't know if you have them here in Florida, but they call them Blarney Stone, Kalani Roses. You know, the ones you walk in and you smell sawdust and beer. You know, the real upscale joints, you know. 3 shots for, you know, $1. You know, all the high-class clientele, they used to have these little bowling machines there that you slide the thing and, you know, and old people looking very hopeless, sitting around there staring at a television, and we didn't have cable then either. And these were the places that I was, you know, me with my intelligent self, like Yogi Bear, better than the average bear, unique like Colt 45. That's how I was living. I would, by now, I'm still got this piece of this job that they're paying me for. Thank them. I'm grateful for that. But I wasn't doing much work when I got there. And I have no money by the weekend. And so on the weekends, me with my college-educated self, with the job at the financial institution, I'm going in the cushions in my sofa trying to find some change to get some, you know, a pint, a night train. Chilled, maybe, maybe not. And then going to the store with my bathrobe on and my raincoat. And the pint fit right in my pocket. And coming back, watching the karate movie with no sound. And sitting there having a grand old time. You know. So in that night, if I'm not gonna, I did all the things I said I wasn't gonna do. I'm on warning at my job, final warning. They don't care, I've been there 8 years. If I'm absent or late one more time, I'm fired. Now, that's a setup. Absent or late, you know, like, whoa. And, you know, I come from this background, too, where, you know, we come from this family thing where you never quit one job unless you have another job. You know, we work, people, in 30 years in the phone company, 30 years in the post office. That's how we used to do. Nowadays, I've changed jobs 3 times just in the past 15 years, 20 years. But in those days, so I wasn't about, but the thought came to me, maybe I've been working too long. Maybe if I don't work, yeah. And so that last year, that summer, I'm on vacation where I used to go on to the Caribbean, you know, Stella getting her groove on now, yeah. Going down there, doing all kinds of stuff, coming back. And but now that year I didn't go. You know, it's different things that make you think that you're okay. And going on a vacation every year made me think I was still okay. And that year I didn't go. And I spent my days sitting in front of the TV with the quarter beer on top, turning the channels, watching the soap operas, and I could turn in between of them without losing, you know, not watching the commercial. And I do that all day. And then at night I go to the bar. And that was my vacation. So I went that another night. I'm not going to do all these things. But before that, I went to a health expo. Yeah, the summer of 84. And I went to see a counselor. See, now I had never considered that anything was possibly wrong with me. I mean, it was wrong with a lot of other folks, but there was nothing wrong with me. But I went to this counselor, and I told him that my problem was there were no decent men left in America. My problem was I didn't have a master's degree. And my problem was that my job didn't appreciate me. He asked me about my drinking. I lied, and he gave me a book on women and alcoholism. I took that book home, and I flipped through that book. My grandmother did not raise an alcoholic, and I was too intelligent to be an alcoholic. That was August of 1984, and I gave him that book back. So by October of 84, another night of I'm not gonna, and that was the early days of the ATM. And now I picked up the other substance again because I was getting drunk. I used to have some great arguments with people about whether I was drunk or not. But by now, I knew I was drunk. And so I believed the lie, and I picked up the other substance, and now I'm a wide-awake lunatic drunk. And so I'm running back and forth to the ATM and going back to the bar, you know, that whole thing. And so I went to work. I got to work that next day. I got the cleanest of the dirtiest clothes. Always kept some Lysol, you know, in the house. It's like spray starch. You spray it on and iron that sucker, you all right. But there was nothing wrong with me. It was y'all, but this is how I was living. And I got to work that day, and it was over. It was over. Did I know I was never going to drink one day at a time again soon? No. But what I did, because see, by now I was going to medical, sleeping stuff off, too. I don't know if you ever tried that for a while. You get to work, then you go to medical because you feel sick, take a nap, come back, and you know, you can kind of work for a few hours. I get to medical that day, and I start to cry. Now, I'm cool. You know, this crying stuff is really getting worrisome now. And I'm doing it at my job, so it's totally confusing. And the things that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that are not coincidences began to happen. The counselor that I saw in August, who asked me about my drinking and gave me that wonderful book, he happened to be in the medical department that day. It was his day off. The doctor says to him, and I can remember it just as clear, "John, do you want to speak to her? She reeks of alcohol." Now, I drank vodka. And I believe that lie too. Vodka doesn't smell. Maybe it doesn't if you occasionally wash, but I wasn't washing. I had seen Psycho. I lived alone. I wasn't going out like that. And so, you know, I did the best I could with the little bit of running water I could find. And then by how my life was, I had stopped really looking in mirrors a long time. Yeah, the way you can look like you're looking in the mirror. Maybe zip around real quick to make sure nothing's hanging real bad, you know, real quick. You know. Then you learn the trick of how to look at people like you're looking at them, but you're really not looking at them. You're looking like past them, but they think you're looking at them. You know, a lot of survival techniques. I didn't know it was shame. I didn't know what it was, but I knew I couldn't do it. They came and asked me do I need help? And everything in my body wanted me to say, get away from me. You don't need anybody. My grandmother told me that you don't need anybody. You don't love them because if you love them, they're going to leave you. Everything in my body wanted me to say that, but what I said was yes. Again, a power greater than myself working in my life. You don't hear a lot of God. You hear no God in my story. I didn't do that. You know, somewhere along the line, it just didn't work for me. However, I thought it could work for you. And if you talk to me, you know, I had to give you all the information. I'd refer you to the nearest synagogue or mosque, you know, or church. But because it could work for you, but it couldn't work for me. I didn't disrespect it because, you know, my grandmother ain't raised no fool. So it was this thing where there was a line, and it was over here. And it stayed over there. By the end of my drinking, when I would get sick, and I like to remember this, I didn't say, oh, please, God, don't. What I was asking God to do, this God, was don't let me die with my head in the toilet bowl. Okay. So that's the wonderful person that came to you in 1984. I went to a treatment program after work, and I began to learn about alcoholism. And then they told me, this is great, Adrian, we're giving you all this information, but you have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And with all my brilliance, I had no idea what AA was. I came here, you were not my kind of people. Remember, I was a mover, a shaker, a doer. You had to have little things written on signs, you know. I mean, like, and there was a guy in my home group who used to talk about brain damage, and I thought, you all really had it. Really, you know, but I'm the kind of person that I noticed that for the first time in a very, very long time, I hadn't picked up the first drink. I hadn't picked up the first drink. So I came to you, and I got a home group, because again, with my intelligent self, I figured I would do everything you told me to do. And with my mature, because alcoholics are so mature, aren't we? I would say, after I did everything you told me to do, and I got drunk, I would look at you and say, nah, 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 it didn't work. So I got a sponsor, I got a home group, I got busy, you know. Please do something for Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't know what you can do, ask somebody, and I'm sure that they'll let you know what you can do for AA. And if what you try at first, and you don't blanket, or you finish, you do it for your 6 months, then try something else. There's always something to do, and there's plenty to do in AA. And that's what I did. My first sponsor was a woman that I picked because it was suggested at that treatment program to get somebody that had at least 2 years, and what was more important, somebody that looked like they enjoyed not drinking. Now, I don't know if you're going to some AA meeting, sometimes you wonder. But this woman loved Alcoholics Anonymous. She got excited. She didn't work. She got dressed to come to meetings, you know. And she would, you know, and she loved helping the newcomer. The dirtier, the better. And you could just watch her change. Oh, hey, she's a newcomer. Let's come with me. We'll get him a half a cup of coffee because he's trembling. And you don't want him to spill it on himself. And she'd get right up on you. And she would grab you and she would touch you. And no one had touched me in a long time. So I kept coming. I got busy in that home group, and things began to change for me. About 6 months, I was sitting in a step meeting, and my home group had Tuesdays step meeting, and on Saturdays, 11 o'clock is a third step meeting, which I chaired for about 3 years because I had trouble with the third step. So they kept saying, well, keep chair the third step meeting. You'll get it one at a time. On Sunday, we have an 11-step meeting. They banned me from that at one point because I would be so confused because everybody would have a God of their understanding and they'd be talking about this wonderful relationship and I would want that. And I would come back and I'd be telling my sponsor and she said, Adrian, that's their relationship. You need to develop your own relationship. So you stay out of that meeting for a little while and we'll just keep working on this. And that's what I did. And then one day, about 6 months, I was sitting in a step meeting and it was the first step. And it was, who cares to admit complete defeat? So in my mature manner, I went home and I could throw myself across the bed. You know, I would take to my bed when things got too much for me in AA. And I cried. I mean, I cried. Who cares to admit complete defeat? And I think that was the day that I finally really did a first step. And I have to do it on a daily basis, but that's when it really hit me. As that counselor told me a long time ago, he said, Adrian, alcohol kicked your... And I wanted to rail at him and, how dare you, don't talk to me like that, what do you mean? But I thought about it, and it won. I didn't have to keep trying again, because it would trick me, you know. I'd have horrible times in that one night I could drink, and I didn't have a lot of trouble. I almost remembered where I was. You know, and where I was wasn't too bad. And I think it was okay. And then the next time I'd be back with those same people I wasn't going to be with again. With no money. It's morning. I got to leave. I got to beg you for a token. and I'm going to try to have a little dignity when I leave out of there. That's how I was living. So I surrendered. I said, it won. Hats off to it. It's better for, you know, you don't have to worry about me one day at a time. And I kept coming. And I began to develop slowly. And I'm glad you told me I could get a God of my own understanding. And that was important to me. And at first it was a creator. And then I'm from the old earth, wind, and fire days. So it was, you know, the universal spirit. And then it was, but you said it was okay, whatever. As long as it was not me, you know. And eventually it would be something that I could rely on, because there comes a time when no human power. But it took time. It took time for me. And I just kept coming. I was active in my home group. I'm still active. My current sponsor that I've had for the past, I think, 11 years now, she's with me. She travels with me sometimes when she can. She's always said, I don't care what you be doing, who you become in AA, you have your home group and you do something in that home group. And I'm the program chairperson. You know, and what we do in New York, we have this big meeting and everybody goes there from the groups, and then we all exchange bookings so that your group can have speakers from other groups come in. It's so hectic and so alcoholic. You know, everybody's yelling and, you know, we're there and we're booking a zillion, you know, but that's what I do for my group. And they even told me, but they made me stop because they told me I booked too many because I got carried away. I got excited, you know, and they said, we're a small group, Adrian. We can't take all the commitments that you're bringing us. So I had my sponsees and stuff taken. But anyway, I am sponsored and I have sponsees. And if you really wanted to, if you want to determine how much you're growing, have sponsees. And that will really help me anyway. Along the line there, fourth step. I was afraid of the fourth step. I was afraid to find out the truth about myself, because I began to realize the day at a time that who I thought I was wasn't really who I was. And it only took for me to get pissed off in AA without a drink. And if somebody must have did something, probably embarrassed me or hurt my feelings, because that can really bring out my defects of character. And the next thing I know, I was saying some stuff that I thought I needed the drink to say. And not only was I saying it, I had assumed the position, you know, and it scared me, you know, because I thought I only acted like that when I drank, because that was my, you know, that was my thing. You know, whenever you want somebody to be cussed out, you call Adrian over there to do it, and she would do it, you know, and I'd take another drink while I was coming over to take care of it. I thought my mouth was my weapon. I handled it well. By the time I finished with you, you didn't even know half of what I said, and I probably didn't know either, but I was impressed by it, and other people were. But I stayed away from a drink long enough to know how cruel that is. I had to do a lot of ninth-step work with that. And then when you do this, I'm very thin-skinned since I stopped drinking, too, and people give it back to you, and I don't drink, and it hurts. So that gives me a chance to see how I must have affected people when I used to do my thing. So I've learned a lot, and it by, not by virtue, from circumstance and sobriety. Restraint of pen and tongue. You can't take those words back. Once they go out, and I know there's time, you just want to pull them back. And I remember looking at people's faces when you say certain things. There was a time when I was drinking, and I wasn't paying rent, and I wasn't doing a lot of things. I went to my uncle, who loves me dearly, and my aunt, who loves me dearly, and I went to borrow some money again, and they were like, no. Yeah. And they didn't never say no to me. I'm the niece, you know. And they were guilty about my mother dying when I was so young. You know, kids learn about that kind of stuff. You know, I knew somebody was trying to make up for something, and I was going to play it for all I could get. So when my uncle told me no, I couldn't believe it. I started crying, and he told me, dry up those crocodile tears, and that really pissed me off then. Yeah. And I remember them looking at me with this look that I am grateful to say that I have not had to see them look at me like that since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. That look when they don't understand that they love you, but they don't understand how you live it. I haven't had to see it since I've been here. Kept coming to AA meetings, started doing, you know, finally did that fourth step, one of a few, identified a lot of things, had to repeat some things over in sobriety, Because in order for me to embrace these steps that you talk about that you need to change, I have to believe that there's a need for me to change. And if everything was because I drank and that's why I did that, some things I had to do in sobriety to see, okay, wait a minute, this needs to be changed. It's not about the drink. It's something about your personality. It's something about your greed. It's something about your fear that you're not going to get what you think you're entitled to get. So you're going to grab whatever you can grab, and it might be somebody else's, but that's okay because I'm not worthy anyway. So we had to do a lot of work in that. I don't keep secrets. There are no secrets in my life. You know, I have a sponsor, and she knows everything about me. And if I can't get to her, there are other women in my life, and I am very grateful for the women of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're the ones who helped wipe away my tears, you know, who encouraged me, who my sponsor after I was sober 10 years, because I always want to know, what am I going to be when I grow up? What am I going to be when I grow up? And she would say, well, if you don't pick up the first drink, you'll be sober. Yeah. You know, and that sounds real cute, but it's like, hey, I want to know, you know. I finally, somewhere along the line, I left the bank and I started working for the city of New York. And I figured if I'm going to be helping people, all right, there's something with me about helping people, moving and, you know, helping you solve problems. So if I'm going to do that, maybe I might get some training. That'd be a good idea. And so after 10 years of sobriety, my sponsor said, well, you can go back and get your graduate degree because I think you've been here long enough to know that you still have to make meetings. It's not meetings or school. It's meetings and school and job. Now, I told people many years ago I was never going to go to work and go to school at the same time. You know, that's heavy. That's adult stuff. You know, I'm going to take a free ride if I can. But I went to school and I worked full time. When things just worked out, and I was able to go back to school and get a master's degree in social work. And I became this social worker that I loved. You know, and I have a thing about, you know, labels. Yeah, I like, you know, a member of the social work organization, carry a social work bag, wear a social work t-shirt, loved it, you know. Life was fine. AA member, life is good, you know. And, you know, even today, at one point I used to say the steps were like carrying a MasterCard, don't leave home without it. And then they become to me sometimes like, I don't watch Zena, my nephew does. Zena, and this whole idea of an arsenal of weapons and what I use to survive and to even find joy and to live comfortably in this day, those 12 steps are what I have. And so there are times when they're during the day when I'm grabbing one, I'm grabbing seven. Oops, got to go back to three. Wait a minute, inventory. Up four. Okay, I'm okay. Pray. 3 and 11. You know, and I think I'm crazy too, but that's the way that I've embraced these principles, because that is the way that I can not only live sober, but to find that joy that they talk about, to be happy, joyous, and free. And then, and somewhere in between that, that's not the goal, but to become somebody that contributes to society, you know, consciously. Now, some of us did it when we were drunk, but, you know, that was like a byproduct or something that I just happened to maybe do something valuable while I was on my way for a drink. But today, that I can be of service, I can be of use. You know? But keeping a bay and asking my higher power, those defects that come in the way of my usefulness to God, self, and others. So it's a daily reprieve contingent upon my spiritual condition. Yeah. And so all this was going good, and I had the job, and you can be a member of the board of the trust, you can be a member of a committee of a trustees board, and they call these appointed committee member positions. If you want more information about that, talk to me later. And I applied for it on the Cooperation with the Professional Community Committee. Now my life was perfect. I was appointed committee member. I was the social worker. I was the AA member. It was just great. Perfect. They had in 1996, there was a early retirement offer at the General Service Office. And some people took it. And they had vacancies. Now, a long time ago, I had written, because you told me I could write down goals now. Somewhere along the line when I was a kid, I remember telling my grandmother, and it took a lot of courage for me to tell my grandmother that I wanted to be a Mouseketeer. And she looked at me, and in her truth, And her reality said to me, girl, go sit down. You know there's no such thing as colored Mouseketeers. So at that time, I consciously said I was never going to tell anybody. Ever. When you sing happy birthday and make a wish, wouldn't make one. Not going to do that. Last year, I went to Disney World, and I got my ears, and they say, Adrian. Right. My aunt and uncle took their 48-year-old and a 9-year-old, we used them as a front, to Disney World. Yeah. I was at the board meeting. They announced the vacancies. I didn't want to do it. I mean, because I have to tell you about it, I had made the list. And on that list was one day working for the General Service Office. You know. But like an alcoholic that I am, not now. That came when the time when social worker got the you know, everything. My sponsor said to me, I think you should put in for it. I don't want that. And she said, I think you should put in for it. Like a good alcoholic again, I went and asked somebody else. You know how we do that. Staff member at the GSO, and I said, oh, my sponsor said, da, da, da. And she said, you don't have the job yet. Just put in for it. Third step. I said, okay. By October of 1996, some things had happened at the job that I was at, and it was not a pleasant place to work at. We were not doing what we were mandated to do. It was a very awful environment to work in, and I got the call. And they invited me to work at the General Service Office, come in for an interview and go through the process. And I went, and I've been there ever since, one day at a time. My life has been incredible. I've had the opportunity to meet people like you. I'm invited to come and to share with you. You know, someone says, oh, you must love telling your story. I said, sure. Anyone would love to come up in front of people that they've never met, strip themselves naked, tell everything about themselves, and then have people come up to you and say, oh, love your story. Love your, oh, thank you for sharing. Oh, But that's how it works. One alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic. There was an innate something that I knew when I came to AA, no matter what I didn't like, what I didn't go for, y'all was a little, you know, kind of cultish too. But when you got up here and you told your story, that gut would start hitting me. And I knew, I felt it. Yes, I did that. I thought about doing that. I didn't want to be like you. And every time I'd want to sit there, keep going like this, something inside would be going like that. The old folks say, I know that you know that you know. And I knew that you all weren't making this stuff up. So I came to you, not like this. Who you see here today is a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never thought that I could love and be loved. And I learned that here. You know, let us love you till you learn to love yourself. I thought that was so silly. You know, I didn't realize how I have been living, because someone said, if you loved yourself, could you have been living like that? You know, those old timers are so wonderful. And keep coming back. And then it came a time when I had to change. And we had one guy, you know, in our group that would go, change or die, change or die. It was like, oh, give me a break. Yeah. My journey, my story, and until I saw the need to change, I couldn't even start to embrace the process. But if you don't drink and you keep coming and you get active, you will. That's my experience, is that you will find a time. It came a time when I was going to pick up a drink or lose my mind. So again, it comes a chance. And I get plenty more opportunities to look at some behaviors. I was in the store the other day, and there's something about when that plastic hits that glass in a store, that credit card, like, bam, and oh, it just sounds so good. Watch it. Defect. Got to pay the bill when it comes. But it ain't nothing like it, especially when it's green and it hits that glass and kind of slides a little bit. Cash or charge, you know. I know, we'll work on that. My sponsor's over there now. Yeah. But I thank my higher power that I am able to pay the bill today. Yeah, that was one of my things too. You know, you can't get blood from a stone, you know, but I don't live like that today. But always constant vigilance about it. And you see like one defect go down and it's okay, and another one starts to crop back up. But if you don't have people in your life that are aware and you don't tell people, so you know again. So I'm here. I love working for you. I mean, sometimes you call the office and you want us to solve the problem, but you really don't want us to solve the problem. You want us to agree with you. And all we have is our collected shared experience. And if it doesn't go with what you want to tell your group with a letter to go back, you get very unhappy with me. To have this region, as each of us has a region, and when I was on CPC, the Southeast region was where I received the correspondence and faxes and emails from. And so when I rotated and I got and I left the Southeast, I went and went to the Southwest. So, you know, just when we think that we could be the worst, somebody says, if we all put our problems on the table, when we serve everybody else, we take our own back. No region is any better or any worse than any other region. We all still have the same problems, the same concerns. When your group isn't doing what you wanted to do, you want to call New York and make New York fix that group. Yeah. And we say, we can't fix it, you have to fix it, but we'll give you lots of information. And then hopefully your group conscience will sit down and determine what works best for you. Yeah. It's been an incredible journey. You know, and all the wonderful things, a God of my understanding, a job that I love, working for the organization that saved my life. But, you know, sometimes I think it boils down to the fact that today, since I stopped drinking, I have not peed on myself. Now, for some people, and I have a sponsor, that really bugs them when I say that. But you see, whatever it takes to make you feel that there's a need, you know, it was humiliating to live like that and to make it seem like it's okay, you know, and to make excuses for it too. And so today, I haven't had to live like that. And for that, I am eternally grateful. Thank you for my sobriety.